Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, June 30th, 2015. The UN mission in South Sudan accuses South Sudanese army of rape, killing, and other human rights abuses in Bentiu.
Our personnel found that in at least 9 separate incidents, women and girls were burnt alive in tukuls after they were gang raped in Koch County and elsewhere.
And a South Sudanese living in the United States receives an award from the White House for his work with refugees in America.
There are over 60 million refugees worldwide today. These are people in need. These people have lost their hope, have gone through so much. So I think it is a responsibility on our hand as people to get back to these people.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The United Mission in South Sudan says in a report released today that civilians in Unity State have again been the targets of extreme violence. Women and girls were raped and brutally killed. Villagers were abducted. Tens of thousands were forced from their homes. During an upsurge in violence that began in April, UN investigators are blaming the violence against civilians on the South Sudan Army with its militia. The UN is calling for the alleged perpetrators to be brought to justice. For VOA News, Charlton Doki reports from Juba.
This is not the first time the UN has accused the South Sudan Army of human rights abuses in the 19-month-old conflict. But UNMI says this time around, the scope and level of cruelty are far greater, suggesting that the violence is driven by something other than political differences. Joseph Contreras, head of public information at UNMI, says victims and eyewitnesses from Unity State's Rubkona, Gwit, Koch, Ler, and Mayom counties were interviewed for the report.
Investigators established that at least 67 civilians were killed during the upsurge in fighting in Unity State that began late April. They also documented about 172 women and girls who had been abducted, an additional 79 women and girls were subjected to sexual violence, including gang rape. Also, our personnel found that in at least 9 separate incidents, women and girls were burnt alive in tukuls after they were gang raped in Koch County and elsewhere.
UNMI says survivors of the attacks told investigators that the SPLA and allied militias from Mayom County were behind the violence. The survivors say the assailants killed civilians, looted and destroyed villages, and displaced more than 100,000 people. UNMI says that in some instances, UN investigators were unable to access sites where the alleged attacks occurred. In some cases, the investigators were barred by the SPLA from accessing the sites, and in other cases, logistical challenges prevented them from conducting a probe. Contreras says the United Nations will continue to monitor and investigate human rights abuses against civilians. He says the authorities in Juba must conduct their own investigations.
We call upon the government to fully investigate these serious allegations of misconduct by members of its own army as well as associated armed groups who worked with SPLA units during this recent offensive. These perpetrators must be held accountable in order to break the cycle of impunity that allows such violence to continue.
Contreras says UNMIS provided advance copies of the report to South Sudan's Foreign Ministry, the SPLA, and rebel representatives. But he says neither the government nor the rebels have commented on the report's findings. SPLA spokesman Colonel Philip Aguer and Defense Minister Kuol Manyang did not answer repeated calls seeking comment on the report. In the past, Aguirre has dismissed allegations of human rights abuses by government forces, but has also welcomed investigations into alleged human rights violations. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
Human rights abuses have been reported on both sides. A U.S.-based civil society group says imposing targeted sanctions on the leaders of both warring sides in South Sudan could force President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar to finally order their forces to lay down their arms. Justine Fleischner of the Enough Project says South Sudan's leaders have done very little to stop the violence which started in Juba in December 2013. She says the international community should act now before lives are lost and the country is destroyed.
In spite of what the government has said, that they're prepared for peace, in spite of what the opposition has said, in spite of the efforts by the IGAD mediation for over a year and a half, there's been absolutely no progress in terms of actually coming to a sustainable political settlement to the conflict. And not only that, but we're seeing fighting is actually intensifying on the ground. Some of the worst atrocities are being committed in places like Bentiu and Upper Nile, and the opposition and government are fighting over the last remaining functioning oil fields in Upper Nile State.
What benefit does the international community bring to this stalemate? Would they solve the problem?
I think that remains to be seen. That's an open question that we're all waiting to see what actually happens, because I think if the addition of other African states, of the UN, of the Troika, if they're not able to bring consequences to bear on the warring parties, including targeted sanctions, accountability measures, then I think this will just continue to go on as we saw the previous peace process unfold. So it really is about the international community getting behind the peace process and imposing consequences if the parties continue this intransigence.
Why this increase or uptick in fighting?
It's quite clear that both sides feel that they can gain something militarily on the battlefield. They've received recent weapon shipments. We hear allegations of support from different regional states, and the parties are just poised to continue fighting in advance of the rainy season to just improve their place in the negotiations so that they can demand more power and better positions in government.
But looking at the dynamics of the conflict, is there really a military solution to this conflict? Because it's rooted in the fabric of the society. Is there a military solution?
There is no military solution to this conflict. If the fighting continues like this, there's going to be nothing left to rule over when everything is said and done. But the warring parties aren't thinking long term. They're not thinking about the development of the country, about their people, about the oil fields and how oil money should be used to develop the youngest country in the world. They're simply thinking about the position and what their piece of the pie will be when everything is said and done. And so right now it seems as if they're willing to sacrifice absolutely everything to continue this war just for whatever their own gain will be at the end of the day.
And in the backdrop of this, where the leaders are thinking about their personal and individual interests, what should the international community do to bring an end to this fighting?
Ideally, we would hit these leaders where it hurts, and that's in their wallets. It would be targeting their bank accounts, their businesses. They live in luxury homes with nice cars and excellent health care in the region and abroad. And that is just inconsistent with the way that people in South Sudan are living. And that disparity needs to be addressed. And so I think we've moved past the point where targeted sanctions are appropriate and warranted in response to the lack of progress in the peace process and also to the horrific atrocity crimes that are being committed.
Allow me to ask you this question just for the sake of our listeners. The work that you and other activists are doing for South Sudan, how does it help the situation?
Ideally, what we're trying to do is to galvanize international support for targeted sanctions, to actually make it unreasonable for the international community to continue to monitor the situation, to condemn the human rights violations, to condemn the warring parties, but actually in practice do nothing. And so continuing to put that pressure, bring the atrocities to the diplomats that are making these decisions and demand that they actually take action.
That's Justine Fleischner, Enough Project policy analyst for Sudan and South Sudan. She was speaking with me in Washington earlier this month. There is some good news on the human rights front. A former child soldier from South Sudan has won an award from the White House for the work he does with refugees and immigrants. Galwakter Touch says he started a refugee aid organization, the Nashville International Center for Empowerment, to help his wife learn English when she came to the United States 10 years ago. Today, Touch, who came to the United States as a refugee in 1996, helps other refugees from around the world. He told Karen Zivogo the story of dedication to others that led him last week to the White House to receive the Champions of Change Award.
My organization was started in 2005. It was after my wife came to America. I started to teach her English in my own apartment. And then with that, we have a number of the women from South Sudan and other part of the other part of the region join my apartment. And then by then, we decided to go and open a place where we can teach them English and other services that they need.
And what other services do you provide now to refugees and to people who are just settling into life in America?
They have need for employment services. They have need for health services. They have need for social adjustment services, immigration services. They have need for supporting the children in the school, like after-school program services. They have need for opening a small business. So we respond to all those needs. We are now receiving refugees from all over the world. Coming here, we provide them with services from the basic need all the way to when they're becoming self-sufficient and also integrated into society.
Tell me a little bit more about how you met your wife.
Yes, my wife was not really a wife at the time. I was only 12 years old. She was about 6 years old. She and our family were in the Eaton refugees camp in the late 90s. So when that camp, that girl used to come through our own compound to get the water from the river. When she returned back, I'll ask her whether she could give me some water. And then she'll turn back and give me a water. And then I was, wow, she had an extraordinary character. And when she grew up, I am going to marry her. About 10 years later, after I left from camp to camp and came to Kenya and then went through settlement program and then came to America, I went through education transformation and change and able to excel and decided to marry someone. I told my parents to check on her so that I can see if she's still alive or if she's still unmarried, then I can go ahead and marry her. That's how I went back and married her in 2004. And then in 2005, so I brought her back to America.
Why do you do this, besides the story of your wife? What drives you every day to go to the office and work for these refugees?
There are over 60 million refugees worldwide today. These are people in need. These people have lost their hope, have gone through so much, you know, violence, war, and so many things had happened, and they did not know what else, where else to go and what else to do. So I think it is a responsibility on our hand as people to get back to these people, give them the basic, do whatever we could. If I can contribute any small thing that I could as an individual, there's nothing else that I would do better than doing this.
And we're coming up to the fourth anniversary of independence for South Sudan as well. How difficult is it for somebody from South Sudan to look at what's happening in the country, know that it's happened before, and that for some reason people still cannot make peace with each other?
It is very difficult to celebrate while people are in the protection of other people and you were in your country. It is difficult to celebrate when half of your population is really going through pain. They're dying because of food and security. This is a human disaster, and it's a man-made kind of thing. The only solution for us to overcome this challenging is for us to find peace. We have to find peace. We have to get along. We have to address the need. We have to know the suffering of other people is our suffering. No matter what other people are doing, no matter how much others are trying to help us, if we're not helping ourselves in addressing our challenges and figure out how to live and work together, we will never be able to overcome.
That was former South Sudanese child soldier Galwakter Touch, who last week was at the White House in Washington to receive the Champions of Change Award for his work with refugees. He was speaking with South Sudan in Focus web editor Karen Zivogo. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Preparations are underway for independence celebration in Jonglei State. That story is coming up after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what makes you sad or happy, and why?
Sometimes when I'm doing my work and I fail, or I get sometimes when I'm not successful with it, I may not be happy with it. But if I finish my work successfully, then I become happy.
Yeah, I actually may get sad when things are not appropriate. And when I'm seeing suffering goes around, it's where I may get sad. And I may get happy when I'm seeing most of my brothers are feeling okay.
When you get money, you'll be happy. And when you don't have money, you don't be happy. You'll be very sad.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. It's time for our Tuesday health segment. Today we are talking about sweet potatoes. A new study published by Harvest Plus shows the vitamin A-rich orange sweet potato can reduce the prevalence and duration of diarrhea among young children in Africa. More than 40% of African children under the age of 5 are thought to be at risk of vitamin A deficiency, and this increases the risk of problems such as diarrhea, which kills more than 350,000 children every year. Harvest Plus and its partner developed a bio-fortified sweet potato in Mozambique that is especially rich in vitamin A. Alan DeBarrow is a senior research fellow at the International Food Policy Research Institute and the co-author of the study. He tells VOA's Kim Lewis how the sweet potato can improve the health of young children.
The way it works is the following. First, children need to be vitamin A deficient. They need to have some sort of deficiency in micronutrients that leads to a lower level of immunity. So basically, vitamin A helps build up your immune system, or it helps your immune system along. And when children don't have enough vitamin A, their immune system won't work as well as it should. By introducing vitamin A through the orange sweet potato, their levels of vitamin A in their blood get higher, and they're better able to fight off infections when they come along. And they come along very often in rural Mozambique.
Where there, it has been proven that young children there are deficient in vitamin A.
At baseline, about 70% of children were vitamin A deficient. It's a major nutritional problem, and this is among children under 5. So it's not only a major nutritional problem, but because it leads to diarrhea and dehydration, etc., there are estimates that up to 30% of deaths of under 5s in Mozambique can be at least indirectly attributed to diarrhea than vitamin A deficiency.
Is the orange sweet potato easy to grow?
It is and it isn't. It's easy to grow during the rainy season. It's not that easy to maintain. So that's a future study we're working on, how it was maintained in the villages after the project ended. But it's easy to grow during the rainy season. You basically just stick it in the ground and they grow. There's a little bit more to it than that. You should probably spread a little bit of ash to disinfect the vines, and that works as a natural pesticide. So we taught that technique, but largely they're fairly easy to grow. That said, during the dry season, the problem with orange sweet potato is it's better to maintain the vines. There are two ways that sweet potatoes are propagated. One is to maintain vines in a wet area, which tend to be these low-lying areas that are a little bit scarce and sort of near like where rivers flow during the rainy season. Or you can resprout the potatoes. So you basically leave some potatoes in the ground to resprout when the rains come again. The orange sweet potatoes don't grow as well when people resprout them. So we taught either to keep a small garden of vines near the house where you could just pour wastewater on them to maintain them during the dry season. And the dry season is 8 months, so it's long. Or we taught them to take vines down to the lowlands to maintain them during the rainy season. It's a bit hard to maintain, but when people are able to maintain them, they're a really good source of vitamin A.
And this is a natural source.
Yeah, it's totally natural. These varieties were bred locally. They were bred in Mozambique. In this case, in Uganda, they were bred in Uganda, and that's not in this study, but there was a parallel study going on in Uganda. And they're hybrids that the varieties were developed specifically to yield as well or better than the more native white sweet potatoes. And they were bred for taste as well. So we've done consumer acceptance studies to ensure that people like to eat them at least as well, if not better, than white sweet potatoes. The other thing to say about that is that not everybody likes them as much or better, but the majority, the large majority of people do.
Do the children actually like it?
Yeah, definitely.
How do they eat it? I mean, how is it prepared and given to children?
It's mostly just boiled and then given to kids.
Where does the biofortification process come into play?
So the biofortification process is, as I said, it's a conventional breeding process where Harvest Plus has taken, and the CG system has taken, planting materials from other places that are orange or high in vitamin A and basically bred them into native varieties, so crossbred native varieties, to make sure that they'll grow well locally.
Alan Debro is a senior research fellow at the International Food Policy Research Institute and co-author of the study. He was speaking with VOA's Kim Lewis from Washington, D.C. The UN Security Council extended the peacekeeping mission in Sudan's Darfur region for another year in spite of the request by the government in Khartoum to withdraw the mission from the country. The peacekeeping force is operated jointly by the African Union and the United Nations. Peacekeepers entered the region in 2007 to restore law and order during a lengthy conflict between the government and armed rebels. The UN estimates as many as 300,000 people have been killed. Some 4.4 million people need aid, and more than 2.5 million people are displaced. Sudan's Deputy Ambassador to the United Nations, Hassan Hamid Hassan, says it is completely wrong to say Darfur is engulfed in war. Meanwhile, International Criminal Court Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda has issued an appeal for UN Security Council to act to ensure justice in Darfur conflict. Her appeal, issued on Monday, said it's long overdue for you to heed the cries of the victims of rape and sexual abuse, torture and mass displacement and other human suffering the people of Darfur continue to endure. The Hague-based court issued an arrest warrant for Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir, who is accused of genocide and other crimes in Darfur. Since 2009, Mr. Bashir, who rejects the court's authority, has traveled within Africa and has not been arrested. Jonglei state government officials have allocated 900,000 South Sudanese pounds, or roughly $285,000, for the upcoming July 9 independence celebration. Thousands of people are planning to gather in Bor to mark the fourth anniversary of South Sudan's independence. Jonglei has been one of the hardest hit states during the 18 months of conflict, but officials and some residents believe they should still honor the country's 50 years struggle for independence. Others say the only people celebrating will be officials who have access to funding. Jacob Achek has this report for VOA from Bor.
Peace in the period of social coexistence. Peace in the point where misunderstanding is gone.
40 children recite a poem written by four teachers at St. Andrew Nursery and Primary School in Bor, Jonglei State. The students are preparing at St. Andrew Episcopal Church to recite the poem during Jonglei July 9 Independence Day celebration. Jonglei officials say civil society organizations, faith-based groups, civil servants, security forces, children, and everyone else in Bor are welcome to join in the celebrations. Jonglei State Information Minister Judy Jonglei Boyre says the 900,000 South Sudanese pound allocated for event is necessary to make sure the celebration is a success.
Preparation is going well according to the plan, because budget for it has already been organized. From Jonglei State is 500,000 South Sudanese pounds, and we're expecting 400 also from the national government to complete the budget of the celebration.
Boyre says there will be special performances that include dancing, singing, and military demonstration. John Manyang Malwe, a member of Bor County Youth Association, has taken part in South Sudan Independence Technical Committee since 2012. He says it's important to honor his country's struggle for independence, but thinks the amount of money being spent is excessive.
This amount of money are not supposed to be used for only one day, because this money may help many poor people in the state level of South Sudan. This amount of money are benefiting this top official who was being given to organize the independence. So those are the people who can benefit from that money.
Philip Thoninyok, a member of parliament representing Bo Town, disagrees, while acknowledging Jonglei State face many challenges. He says officials and residents alike must celebrate their very survival and fabulously demonstrate their hope for peaceful coexistence.
We are very happy that we have to celebrate it. And we will never mind whether we have money or whatever. Our gathering is important. Even without money, we have to gather and celebrate it. It's ever right for us to celebrate it. It is very important. And I think even the counties which are under control of the rebels, if they are really South Sudanese, they can celebrate wherever they are.
Enyok says the rainy season prevents most residents from traveling to Juba to cheer in the national events. Bor County's Commissioner Isaac Mameruk is encouraging the state's internally displaced people or IDPs to celebrate as well. Rook told those in Minkama and IDPs came in Lagos State, Awerial County, to enjoy the big celebration being prepared for them there.
The coming independence is going to be colorful independent. It is organized all over 10 states and the national government. And all citizens of Southern Sudan are very happy to show up for 9 July independence celebration, because it is something that we have been fighting for almost 50 years.
Board Assistant Secretary James Deng Akir says organizing this celebration illustrates the hope for lasting peace and reconciliation in the country, even though conflict continues.
This is a time we should come together and celebrate our independence. Though there are challenges, it is not going to be the one that will bind us back or take us back. Let us go forward. Let pray for peace at the church. Let pray for peace as all religious denomination, regardless of background.
Jonglei State has not been stable since South Sudan gained its independence almost 4 years ago. Due to cataract stealing, child abduction and tribal conflicts, in 2012 there was hope that the various communities of Jonglei State were beginning to reconcile. But that peace was interrupted a year later when fighting broke out between the rebel and government forces, and continues today.
Hello, South Sudanese! Do you remember the day we were in the bush? We are rejoicing on the day of independence.
For BOA News, I'm Jacob Achek from Bor, Jonglei State.
And that report by Jacob Achek brings us to the end of our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Mawazo by Diamond. Ngekona wizo na ngekonyo takombe ni kukosa mawazo. Mana mchana kutota usiku silale makazi wangu kikwazo. Ngekona wizo na ngekonyo takombe ni kukosa mawazo. Mana mchana kutota usiku silale makazi wangu kikwazo. Siku juu mapenzi bara, tena ni maradhi ya moyo kupendaga. Tena mapenzi kara, yanajenga chuki na choyo kwenye kaba. Mtu wangu na thamani, ina mana kweli ya kunijua. We have been listening to Diamond and the song Mawazo. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We are glad you could join us. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.